Hey everybody, this is Richard Nikolai, Free the Animal, and I'm starting something new, different here in keeping with what I've been blogging about and expanding this whole thing, the whole nature or animal nature of man and differentiating it from other animals. Instead of just talking about diet and body composition and health and so on. There's also mental health and there's social health. But let's get right into it. I'm going to introduce you to Greg Swan. And my first question, of course, is who's Greg Swan?
I am a meatball. I am Fred Flintstone. I am a middle-aged, middle-class, middle American guy. I live in Phoenix. I work as a real estate broker, which is a hard way to make an easy living. Bloodhound behind us there. There is a Bloodhound Realty is my brokerage. I publish a blog called Bloodhound Blog, which is a major real estate industry web blog. But what I've done here, the book that I've written is about my own philosophical explorations going back to when I was 19 years old. So I've been thinking about the ideas that are in Man Alive in the book that I wrote since I was 19 for 33 years and got to a point where I couldn't stand not to explicate them fully any longer. And so I sat down and wrote 32,000 words, 2 to the 15th words. I wanted it to be 2 to the 13th, which is 8,192 words, but I couldn't do it that short, so about four times that length.
Now, you've been writing for a long time. I remember an old, I don't even know, it's probably still up, but you had a website a long time ago called Greg Swan Writes. So you've always kind of been into expressing yourself in the written word.
Since I was a teenager, I was a photo geek in high school and ended up starting off writing my own photo captions and then really not liking the way that the reporters were writing the stories around my photos. And so I started writing my own news stories for the student newspaper. I ran the student newspaper in college. I've written my entire life. I hate the publishing business. You were talking about the economies of scale. There was a time when I was very young when I really fought that battle and, having envelopes in the mail back and forth. And dealing with the rejection and the extremely small paychecks when I did get paid, and I just stopped doing it. I stopped worrying about it. The internet came along just at the right time for me, and I was able to find the audience that I was looking for, not necessarily the compensation I was looking for, but the audience that I was looking for by publishing on the internet, and I've done that ever since. You and I met, I think, probably 1995 or 1996. On Usenet and traded a lot of stuff back and forth and a lot of mail over the years since then. But because of Usenet, because of the web blogging world, et cetera, it's always been real easy for me to publish. And that was what I did here too. I mean, the book is free. I don't charge anything for it. I don't want to charge anything for it. To the contrary, I want people to give it away as far as fast as to as many people as they possibly can. I want to transmit these memes as widely as I possibly can, and so I deliberately didn't put a price on it because that just slows the penetration into the marketplace.
You may not remember this, but the first time I took real note of you was in a Usenet post in the Alt Philosophy Objectivism news group, and it was a response to something. What's his name? Brad Issa, but A is A,
Yes, sir.
had said to you, and you started it off with, "Do you think I don't know who you are?" And it really struck me because it said that you really that by his response you knew exactly where he was coming from, kind of what his sense of life is. Just a tiny anecdote to throw out there, but I've actually used that a lot of times when someone responds and it's like, I know exactly where they're coming from. And so you proceed on from there. Okay, so let's get into the book. You gave the word count. I think it's about 75 pages. You can I read it last Sunday, and I read it on and I think in two sessions, probably total time, maybe 3 hours, something like that. Very easy to understand. It's interestingly literary in the sense that you reference a lot of things things that you don't commonly find in writing, and you use a lot of Latin terms because you're, kind of a Latin expert going back. So tell us about the book.
The entire argument of the book is built around a defense of the idea of the self. The self as an idea of your life that you start to abstract while you're still a toddler before you can think in concepts. But as you are mastering language and mastering the art of conceptual thinking and mastering the art of free will, choosing by informed discretion based on conceptual reasoning, which is what makes us different as animals from every other organism, is the ability to reason and choose in concepts. As you are mastering that technology, because that's what it is, at the same time you are developing an idea of your life. I call it the self. You could call it the ego. I don't know what other name you could give it. I prefer to call it the self because the word ego has so many negative connotations, and it's not what I'm talking about at all. This is a necessary consequence of thinking as a human being, is to have this idea of the self. And my argument would be that the self is necessarily the cardinal value of your life, that it is the highest value of your life because it is the idea that you must think about almost exclusively. 90% or more of all of your thoughts are going to be an internal dialogue of you with yourself, this internal monologue that you maintain all the time. We are all constantly thinking, and most of what we are doing when we are thinking is not externally observable. It doesn't result in any physical consequences, whatever. And the things that we do that do result in physical consequences are expressions of the self. I would argue that the purpose of human life is the expression of this idea of the self, is self-expression. And so we start off in the first third of the book, we are developing that one idea. Basically, we're developing it from the ground up. This is a proof, and I regard it as a philosophical proof. I think it's an interesting book. I hope it is. I hope it's interesting to read and fun to read, that it's rewarding to read, but it is a philosophical proof that I'm doing. And the first third of the book is devoted to developing the idea of the self. The second third of the book is devoted to the idea of self-adoration, because my argument would be that taking account that the self is necessarily the cardinal value of your life, that the cardinal virtue of your moral philosophy would be self-adoration, would be to construct a self, to construct an idea of your life that is worthy of your own adoration, worthy of your own worship. And most of what people say when they talk about the idea of egoism or selfishness or things like that, most of what they're talking about typically consists of spite. That someone will do something that is really nasty, really spiteful, and people will say, oh, that was so selfish. No, that wasn't selfish at all. Actually, you know where, I'll tell you where the genesis of this book is the fountainhead. And it really is one line, Ayn Rand's book, The Fountainhead, and it is one line. And the line is, in what act of his has there ever been a self? And if you want to understand what I mean by self-adoration, all you have to do is think of it that way, that everything that you do that advances or enhances your own interests, in the short run and in the long run, this is an expression of self-adoration. And everything that you do that diminishes or degrades your own values in the short run and in the long run, is an instance of self-destruction. And self-destruction cannot possibly result in self-adoration. It doesn't matter how much of it you do. The more you do, the worse it's going to be for you. And to the contrary, the more that you honor and pursue, avidly pursue your own values, the better your life is going to be. I mean, obviously this would be the case in terms of pecuniary interests, in terms of the pursuit of money or success in your career or things like that. But every value that you have, like the dog that we were talking about, Richard has a 15-pound dog, which I consider to be a big yappy cat.
Two 15-pound dogs. So 30 pounds altogether.
Two 30-pound dogs. That's two.
Two 15-pounders, so 30 pounds altogether. But I have 30 pounds a dog.
There we go. Your wife, your dogs, your house, your property, your investments, your extended family, your friends, your career. Everyone that you know, everyone that you love, these are your values. And obviously your values exist in a hierarchy. And certainly, you know, if you were, this is a hypothetical situation and people love hypothetical situations, so I necessarily hate them. But if you were in a situation where you had to choose between your dogs and your wife, it would be a no-brainer. I mean, obviously you don't want to be in that situation. It'll never arise. But you can evaluate, you can put your values into a hierarchy just by introducing those kind of hypothetical decisions in your mind. And so people will say, oh, no, I could not ever put myself first. My family comes first. No, what was the word that was important in that sentence? The word was my. My family comes first. And what that means is providing for my family matters to me. Leading my family matters to me. You know, making sure that my family has everything they need matters to me. And the word me, this is what we're not supposed to say. I disagree with this completely. Yeah. And all right.
So let me get a little precise on this. Now, so Greg, so, you know, this kind of, how do you differentiate your ideas? Because I can remember way back when I read some Ayn Rand and the idea of jumping in the river to save, even a stranger. I recall her saying that it still is kind of a selfish act because we as social beings don't want to really live in a world where there's nobody who ever comes to the rescue of anybody else. It's like, oh, that's their problem sort of thing. Are you on the same lines, or do you differentiate that at all?
I would disagree with that in a big, big way, because your life is your whole life. Mm-hmm. What I have been working on since I was 19 is understanding an idea of egoism that makes sense to me in the context of a fully human life. And too much of egoist arguments in general, including Ayn Rand's, but Stirner, Nietzsche, there are a lot of people that you could name who are, you know, bright lights in egoist philosophy, tend to argue from end state theories. Ayn Rand was an anti-Marxist. She wasn't even a pro-capitalist. She was an anti-Marxist. And everything that she did in her career, I mean, it's not, I don't want to diminish what she did, because what she did was vitally important, but everything that she did ultimately was designed to drive a stake through the heart of Karl Marx. And so Galt's oath, I swear by my life and my love of it that I will never live for the sake of another man, we're focused on other people, not on the self, nor ask another man, again, focused on other people, not on the self, to live for my own. This is an other-centric egoism. It's not egoism in the way that I see it at all. And so, again, it's your hierarchy of values. Your dog is drowning. Your dog ran off and jumped in the drink, not knowing that he could not possibly swim well enough to get out. What are you going to do about that? It depends on the circumstances, frankly. But in a normal case, obviously, you would go bounding in the water and haul that dog out. And really, ultimately, it boils down to what is the risk to your own life? Because you may at some point say, I can't do this, as much as I might want to, and as I know this is going to haunt me for the rest of my life. And that's another factor that really matters, is that everything that you do is going to impress itself on your memories, and those memories are going to recall themselves to you. And so if you are in the unfortunate circumstance where you have to watch your dog drown because there's nothing that you can do to rescue that dog, this is a net negative on your life. You cannot insist that, oh, because I protected my bodily utility, I protected my body, therefore what I did was a virtue. Your memories will not let you get away with that claim. Your memories will regret that incident forever. And there's no way of getting around that. And everything that you do is going to be a value or a disvalue. And obviously everything that you have control over that you can cause to be a net positive to your life, you should do. Everything that you can do that will avoid a negative, ongoing negative in your life, you should do to avoid it. But there's a calculus of loss in play anyway, and there are certain things that you're just going to suffer no matter what. You can do absolutely the best thing you can do, and you're still going to suffer for it.
I really like that in the book, and it's so simple. In fact, you introduce it as a grade school sort of a thing. You know, the numbers along the top of the blackboard, you know, from positive numbers to negative numbers. And so in one sense it's very simple, and there is something that I like about the fundamental simplicity in the book is that you can make a philosophical argument about this and retribution, and I'm going to ask a specific question about that in a minute, but you know, retributive justice and so on, but it's what your message is is really the philosophical argument, or sophistry, for lack of a better term, sophistry gone run amok, you know, unbridled reductionism, you know, however you want to term it. But you're saying you can't escape your own memory. So no matter what the philosophical arguments are, if you think they justify you in doing something, pursuing some value or pursuit or whatever values you choose, that, you know, you're going to have to live with that.
Right.
The philosophical arguments be damned. Am I on the right track there?
Correct. Absolutely correct. Right. And, you know, frankly, we lived through that in the 20th century. One really monstrous doctrine after the next, where people convinced themselves that they could get away with anything because they were justified by some philosopher's verbiage. And unfortunately, that's not the case. It is not true. And I talked about it briefly a couple of weeks ago in the subject of abortion. And abortion is one of those things that drives everyone crazy. But from the point of view of self-adoration, there cannot possibly be a circumstance where abortion could be a net positive. And I have my own sins to atone for in this regard. I mean, I've never been involved directly in an abortion, but I financed one, I counseled, I encouraged another one. And these are enduring regrets to this very day. I mean, my involvement was minimal. And yet these are enduring regrets to this very day. This is 30 years ago now. And here they are, here I am still talking about this. And it will be with me till Alzheimer's sets in. I mean, that's my escape, is, you know, memory loss in old age.
So what you're saying, just to take that argument specifically, because it's a very highly charged thing, you would never try to stand in the way or have the state stand in the way of someone getting an abortion. What you're saying is that how is it going to affect you?
Right. Right.
No matter whether you're the woman or the man. Right.
Or the doctor or the financier, if you're directly involved one way or another in this, it's going to cause regrets in your mind, and there's no escaping that. I mean, I likened it, frankly, to strangling cats. Obviously, aborting a baby is a much more serious moral act than strangling cats, and so if you want to argue that there's some moral good to be realized from aborting babies, why don't you strangle a few cats first and see how that works out? Or, I mean, it doesn't even have to be that big. Go out of your way to kill a whole bunch of bugs. You kill one bug, it's not going to make that much difference to you, particularly if it's, you know, nearing your food supply or something like that. But if you set out to go out and become a serial killer of bugs, it's going to affect your mind. It's going to affect your behavior in real time and going forward. It's going to impress itself on your memories. And there is no escape from this. And so, no, I wouldn't, other than instant self-defense of my life, my loved ones, my property in real time, frankly, I wouldn't stop anyone from doing anything, mm-hmm. ever.
Yeah.
But I would argue that there are actions that you can take that will be enduringly damaging to your own self-image, and that if you can avoid doing that sort of thing, so much the better. And to the contrary, if you can do positive things instead, that your life is going to be better, enduringly better.
Okay, a couple more things. One, you know, you're a kind of a libertarian guy, stated loosely, as we all are, kind of an anarchistic guy, as I am, and so many others. But you kind of have a different approach, and one of the things is particularly with the libertarian community and the anarchist community, I'll never forget. You know, there's a fairly well-known anarchist, David Friedman. He's the son of Milton, and he wrote a book a long time ago, Machinery of Freedom, which most of us have read. It's free on the web now. But I remember one time, I think he was involved in this debate in Reason magazine way back when I first started blogging. And it may have been a comment that you wrote on No Treason or one of those other websites, but you said something like, David Friedman looked at the monopoly of force and decided that the problem was monopoly.
Right. And that's Rothbard, too. Friedman and Rothbard both make essentially the same argument, that the problem with the monopoly on force is a monopoly, and if we had competing bands of thugs, armed thugs, running around frog marching people around and doing cavity searches on them, that would somehow be a benefit.
Because, and this was because, because we could choose which one we wanted to
persecutor, yeah, and right. choose another persecutor to inflict upon the neighbors. There's no way, if you imagine a voluntarist community, if this is what anarchists talk about, or at least anarcho-capitalists talk about, is voluntary civilizations, would you volunteer to have your home searched?
No.
The cops come knocking on the door. They say, Richard, the neighbor said you stole his TV. Can we come in and take a look around and make sure the TV's not here? Would you volunteer for that?
No.
Of course what?
Not. Yeah, no.
No, you wouldn't. And so now we have arrived at the limits of a voluntarist community, is that Richard is willing to volunteer for anything that doesn't result in a net disadvantage to him. And that's the extent that we can agree on anything. If we anything beyond that requires the imposition of force, because you won't agree to it. You won't agree to be strip searched. You won't agree to be cavity searched. You won't agree to be locked up overnight. You won't.
Right.
And so if these things are going
to
happen,
so they have to force you to do it.
It has to happen involuntarily. It has to happen involuntarily one way or another. I mean, they don't necessarily have to force you. I suppose they could drug you and then carry you.
Yeah.
But one way or another, it has to be involuntary, because you do not volunteer to do this. And this is one of those things. Friedman and a lot of the people who make arguments about anarcho-capitalism start from the presupposition that when everything is completely different, it'll be exactly the same.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so, when everything is completely different,
that's the whole utopian fallacy, I guess, for lack of a better term, is this idea that if I'm arguing for freedom, individualism, voluntarism, that I somehow have to convince the person I'm arguing with that, don't worry. It's gonna essentially look like the same thing. It's only different, but it's the same. Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
For instance, all roads. Obviously, all roads are going to be privately owned, if there are any roads. But I mean, I can't even predict. But if all property is privately owned, how are the police going to get to your house? They have to trespass to get there. Not just trespass on your land. They have to trespass on hundreds of people's land,
right,
in order to get to your house, in order to search for that television. I don't want to belabor this, because it is way off in the future. It really doesn't matter right now. We're living in a philosophical lifeboat right now. And the important thing, I think, for people everywhere, not just the United States, but all over the world, I think the important thing for them to understand is that they have been misled through 10,000 years of philosophy. Since we have written philosophy, philosophy has been devoted to misdirecting your attention away from your true interests, your own true values, misdirecting them away from that and toward the objective sought by some ideologue, by some demagogue.
Yeah.
And my objective in writing this book is to help ordinary people understand how to discover the self,
right,
and how to live according to their own individual values, how to pursue their own values and not get swept up in other people's manias.
Right. Now, let's get back. And I'm going to have one final question for you. We've kind of gotten a little bit into the specific. I have a lot of libertarian readers. If they're not anarchists, they're very libertarian. I try to be an equal opportunity criticizer. You know, I like to criticize all of these things. Is there something more before I ask my final question that you want to put out there about your book? And I think putting it towards the person who's looking at this and saying, none of this makes any sense to me. I've never been engaged in any of this libertarian or anarchist philosophy.
I'm not interested in that, to be honest with you. I'm an anarcho-capitalist. I qualify as a libertarian. You could call me an individualist politically. I am an egoist. And the book is about egoism. It is about self-adoration. And what I'm interested in is individual people, ordinary people, not people who are, you know, deeply read in politics on the left or the right. It doesn't really matter to me. Ordinary people, the people who are basically just being dragged along in these intellectual disputes, I'm interested in talking to them directly and encouraging them to marshal their mental resources, marshal their intellectual capital in order to discover how they've been misled all along and how not to be misled going forward, how to honor their own values before everything else. And if they do that, I will tell you that if they do that, if they learn how to do that, then they will discover individualism, libertarianism, ultimately anarcho-capitalism. And that, you know, that could take a long, long time. In the short run, all I want is for people to stop sacrificing their own interests to demagogues and instead honor, praise, cherish, worship those interests, their own lives, their families, their children, their spouses, their property, their neighbors, their friends, their family, the things that they actually know and love, to honor and cherish those things. And if people will do that, if we can, what I'm doing is I'm converting the world to egoism. That is my objective. I want to convert the entire world to this idea of self-adoration.
Because they do it, they generally do it anyway. They just give lip service and allow themselves to feel guilty because they can't really live for someone else. They have to really live for themselves. So why not let's just cut to the chase and call it for what it is and realize that we're social animals. And if everybody is trying to advance their own life, let the fact that we're social animals take care of the rest.
Right. And if you look out for your own, then those values are taken care of. And if everyone is looking out for their own values, then everyone's values are taken care of. We don't need to depend on each other, certainly not in a coercive way. I mean, voluntarist way, I have no problem with that. I have 8 cats in this house. It's not my doing. It's my wife. She can't let a furry creature starve. And you could say, oh, well, that's a self-sacrifice. No, it's not. It's the way she is. It's what she does. It's what she loves. It makes her happy.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. And this is, you know, we were talking about the kind of Randian egoism. That's an objection that they would raise. Oh, how could it possibly make her happy? Well, it's her values, not your values. That's why. And she has the right to be who she is and to pursue her own values. And as long as she's doing that, then she's living appropriately as far as I'm concerned. And I think you're right that most people really are living appropriately in the large. And the only issue that they have is they're facing in the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. That they're bowing to Jerusalem or to Mecca or to Moscow or name it. There are a zillion and one motives that people can have that are contrary to their own interests, and yet in their behavior they're largely appropriate in their behavior, and all they really need to do is embrace the values that they truly honor in their everyday lives. All they need to do is embrace them philosophically, and once they do that, the whole world changes overnight and we rid the world of tyranny overnight. I'm not kidding. I think 500 days. We could do this in 500 days. And if it ends up taking 500 years, I mean, that's the way things typically work out. So, oh well, dang, I would love to live to see it. I want to do this so that I can live it. Mm-hmm. But I can't control that. The only mind I can control is my own.
Yeah. Okay, so now one final question for you, Greg, and that is, I remember back in sometime mid-2000s, well before the whole economy kind of blew up, and you kind of had an attitude, as I recall, and you know, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but it was kind of like, things getting better all the time, sort of an attitude. You weren't very interested in arguments that were going to hell in a handbasket. When I read Man Alive, I was like, it seems to me his thinking has changed on this. He's not that you don't think it could turn around, you just said that. But at the same time, it seemed to me that you were saying that things are not necessarily getting better. Could you speak to that? Have you changed your mind on that view?
It depends on what things you're talking about.
Well, okay.
Technology is obviously getting better. Medical technology, I mean, there are all kinds of things that are constantly getting better. Politically, no. And things are much worse than they were in the mid-90s and in the mid-2000s. They're much worse now. And frankly, this is the accelerating consequences of socialism. I mean, the essence of socialism is that it is a self-destructing machine. That's what it is. It's a machine that tears itself apart. And I hope I'm not being offensive to some of your readers by saying this, but this is the way it actually works. And there is no contrary argument to this. You cannot find a case where socialism has been tried where it doesn't result in prison camps and mass graves. Yeah. This is ultimately what happens. Is this the future of the United States? I certainly hope not. I'm working against that. That's what I'm trying to do. But it certainly couldn't happen. And one of the reasons that I wrote this book now is because if it does happen, and then obviously it could happen in the third quarter of this year, the United States could collapse. We are right on the precipice. And I don't know. It could happen this year, it could happen next year, it could happen 5 years from now, or maybe never. But our course toward socialist self-destruction has not abated. To the contrary, it is accelerating. We haven't reversed direction in any way at all, with the possible exception of the state government of Wisconsin. We haven't reversed direction in any way at all. And the only way out of this is to reverse direction. And the question is, will we do it before or after an economic collapse? And either way, I want For Man Alive to be there for people to understand how to honor, respect, cherish, adore their true values. And I hope that it's not. I mean, I think I said this to you in email last week, that it could be the most popular book in the concentration camps. I hope that doesn't happen. I'm working very hard to make sure that doesn't happen, but I can't prevent it alone. I need your help. I need the help of 7 billion busy earthlings getting busy to discover their own values and to stop being gulled, stop being conned by demagogues. And if that happens, we can avoid this fate. And if it doesn't happen, then we can rebuild from it later.
Right. Right. Well, you know, I mean, I don't generally follow the news too much. I take the attitude that important news will get to me anyway. So I don't spend any time on the cable channels or listen to talk radio anymore or anything like that. But, you know, it's hard to escape notice of kind of what's going on in Greece. You know, I mean, deeply socialist country for a long time, and it has been a gradual decline. I've been there. It's an idyllic place in a lot of ways, but I mean, the work ethic is just atrocious. You know, I could go on and on with that. It's kind of like it's almost a third world country, except for all the great stuff that came way before. You know, they have a heritage, which I think keeps it from just being going to Mexico or something like that and seeing beggars in the streets. But it's very interesting how once, you know, financial realities are starting to kick in and so on with some of these measures that they're trying to undertake, how resistant they are to any of those changes. Quite interesting. Well, I want to say in closing that you know, regardless, I wanted to do this video regardless of what you think of it, what you think of me or Greg. You really ought to download this free book and give it a shot. It's going to be unlike anything you've ever read. You are going to see dozens of arguments and things to make you think that I promise you, you've never seen in your life before. And even if you're a libertarian or an anarchist or an atheist or all three, it's going to challenge your way of thinking in some ways and give you a little bit of different perspective on why do I do this? Why am I this way? And I think give you with a better sense of why you have these, you know, individualist libertarian arguments. So I want to encourage you to give it an honest look. And I want to thank Greg for taking a few minutes of my time. Yes. We'll get this post up within a day, and we'll talk about it in comments. Thanks, Greg.
Bless you, sir. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.